podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Weekend of This Week. It's Neil Atkinson, and coming up, we've got five books we're going to be speaking to you about. We've got Sy Hughes to talk about the Athletics book. We have got Magic Sponge, a book I've actually contributed to with 4,500 words. That is to come as well. Daniel Gray on his excellent Extra Time. And for the Blues, our Blue Brethren, we've got David Prentice. But we are going to start with Melissa Reddy, who's written a book called Believers, How Jurgen Klopp Transformed Liverpool into Title Winners. And it is a massive relief, Mel, to say that the book is tremendous. It would have been awful for both of us and for our friendship if it had been a bit rubbish, but it's not. It's genuinely brilliant, and I want to talk to you a bit about the process and what's actually within the book. You've used, I think, the interviews you've done over many a year with Jurgen, your own observations, but you've also done 6 or 7 quite intensive long interviews with people very close to what Jurgen's done at Liverpool. This isn't something that you've just sort of thrown together in no time at all, despite the fact that it is obviously close to the title win. You've really gone out and spoken to a number of people, not least the captain, who comes out of the book brilliantly, but speaks so well and so intelligently.
Yeah, and you know, you say I've taken a lot of time with it, but I had the shortest deadline man, a month to do all the interviews and stuff, and to do the writing, the research amidst COVID, where it's so much more difficult to arrange stuff. And also remember that this was when Project Restart was in full swing, so the players had games, and then they had 2 weeks off where the last thing they wanted to do was chat about football. So yeah, it was quite taxing, but I wanted to do it justice, because when you've followed something so intensively and you're practically stitched into it, I think I didn't want to do the story any bit of disservice. So Jordan Henderson, I think, sets the tone so well in this, in terms of, I think he is the opposite to Jurgen in a sense of where the manager is so good with dealing with defeat and setbacks, and how you know, you channel your mind to get it out of your system as quickly as possible. Henderson in the book reveals that his nature is the opposite, you know, takes defeats really badly. He wears it so heavily. He feels the burden of responsibility. And as it goes through, you can tell how much Jurgen has not just changed him, but changed the mentality, the psychology of the entire squad, how everybody's so subscribed to what he wants from them and what he needs from them. And I think as much as this is a book about the manager and the transformation he's had on the club as a whole, throughout each chapter, you can tell the transformation on individuals, and not just the players and the staff, but also the fans, who, you know, there's a thread through as well in the book.
The book is about the building blocks, and, you know, we're going to talk more next week as well, a more extensive interview around it. But one of the things that I really want to get into in that is the extent to which Jurgen obviously brings so much of himself, but also I think he himself shifts his outlook as it goes through. So one of the things that you touch on in the book, in arguably more detail than anybody has so far, is, for instance, around Buvak's departure, and exactly why that Jurgen felt like that was the right thing to do at that moment, at that time, having initially turned up with him. What his job needed at Liverpool then was for Buvak to no longer be present. And that's something which, as I say, no one really's ever decided to grasp, because it's actually quite a soft conversation. It's not one grand moment of a falling out or anything like that. It's almost the realization that the face no longer fit what Jurgen needed and what he felt the club needed.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues with Jurgen having such a massive personality and stuff, which is, you know, the thing everybody pinpoints about him, charismatic, magnetic, the laughs and the hugs, is you miss out on everything underneath that, which is so important. Jurgen is able to evolve, you know, and we've seen that tactically, we've seen that approach-wise, but the way he handles big moments and other things that could be a massive issue, as though it's absolutely nothing at all. And, you know, you mentioned Buvac's departure there. That shows, one, evolving. It shows putting the club ahead of himself, his own personal friendships and such. It also shows how something, you know, usually when an assistant manager goes and there's been a little bit of a falling out, or there's an ill feeling around it, it can be detrimental. It can have a knock-on effect. And if you remember the conversations at the time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, everyone was saying, oh, the brain's gone, Liverpool are going to fall apart now, or the pressing's gone and all that. And there was absolutely no drama around it from Liverpool themselves. It was a normal, they handled it quite normally. This is a departure of a staff member. We carry on. And he does this quite often. When Fabinho was signed, you know, £40 million plus player, and he's not in the squad, he's not starting, and he waits until October, externally, the conversation is, have Liverpool actually signed a dud here? Is this guy leaving to go to PSG in January? Because, again, that was the sort of conversations happening around that time. And it was all calm. No, we're patient. He's on a very specific training program. He needs to understand how to play as a number six on his own, because he was used to doing it in a double pivot. You look at Coutinho's departure, same thing. You know, this was Liverpool's star player, key man. And everyone around the club is thinking, we're in such a good moment. If we let Phil go, you know, are we setting ourselves up for failure here? And he's like, hang on, this is just an ordinary football transfer. If we make it bigger than what it is, it will feel bigger than what it is.
Do you think, talking about the whole stretch, because the book covers the whole stretch from Jürgen's arrival in 2015, a little bit of prologue, but then sort of gets into a lot of detail in terms of the way in which Jürgen's gone about it, the impact he's had on others, then the impact that those others have had. I think you repeatedly refer to the three senior setters of the standards in terms of Milner, Henderson, Lallana, and then within that, the very senior, almost brains trust element of Van Dijk and Gini Wijnaldum. So it isn't just Jürgen leaves the room for these people to operate. But what the thing you keep coming back to is being calm and being measured. Do you think that that's almost like a deliberate decision from Jürgen in terms of coming into Liverpool, in that Liverpool has enough emotion, it has enough anxiety, it has enough desire, all of that stuff we've got in abundance. And maybe if he'd have ended up going to another club in an alternative universe, he might actually have brought less calm, the opposite of calm. Like, do you think it either just suited him perfectly and he's grown into it, which is something I want to talk more about, or do you think he's actually adapted himself a little bit differently to the way in which he did at Dortmund to be the piece Liverpool needs?
I think it's a bit of both. One, because actually by nature, he's very detailed, he's meticulous, he's into organization, he cares about numbers, and he cares about learning so much more beyond his role. Because when he first started in management, he did everything. Obviously, he studied sports science. So he's got a good understanding of other roles, and he takes an interest in it. So I think by nature, he is somebody that is quite, I think, you know, what we see in game settings when he reacts emotionally, yes, that's him, but away from the touchline, he is quite calm, considered, measured things long term. So that's natural. But yes, definitely the first thing he assesses about Liverpool before he comes in is that everyone is wearing so heavily the weight of not winning the title, that it's coloring everything. He speaks about body language. He talks about, you know, every misplaced pass being, you can hear the frustration from the fans. So before even walking through the doors, he knew there was too much emotion. Is really good, but the emotion was being channeled in the wrong way. It was becoming a noose instead of motivation. And so I think he, again, comes in, and all the players, you know, in the book, they talk about expecting this. This is the way we do things. This is the law. This is, and yes, he did tell them counter-pressing's the law and all that stuff. But he also told them, right, all this pressure, all this expectation, all this winning the league, thinking about winning the league, all this Liverpool's history, it stops. I'm not here to tell you we're going to repeat what happened in the past. I'm here because I believe in you guys and we can write an incredible story together, but we can only do that if we reset our minds and leave all the stuff behind. So he taught them to actually channel the emotion in a positive way, in a helpful way. And actually, he's taught us all that. The fan base, even the media, like you look at the game so differently because of everything he's said from day one until now.
Just to sort of finish it off for this part, there is, Mel, within this has become a portion of your life. Frankly, you just said before about being sort of embedded in it. It's an interesting way to sort of, you're now obviously still write about Liverpool. Liverpool will always be a massive story. No matter where you go, Liverpool will always be a massive story, and you'll always have your sort of friends and contact there. But is this a little bit for you, when you were writing this book, was this a little bit, not the end of something, but what I mean is almost packaging this part up and saying, this is my definitive word on this period of time, which I lived through and lived this close to this manager, interviewed him all the time. These footballers, spoke to them a great deal in mix zones and so on, was on this journey with them. Is that you sort of psychologically going, there's this, take this away now, we've done this, let's go and do the next thing?
I think so, because, we talk about Jordan Henderson evolving in the book. We talk about Jürgen Klopp evolving, and I think it's important that I evolve too and grow. And I think that's the same for pretty much everyone. But I was so, I did so many long form articles before doing this book. And in my head, every time I did a long form, I always thought, I should be doing a book. Like, one day I hope I'll do a book. And I just didn't know how or when, or how do you find the time, how to be so disciplined doing it. I didn't know how to do any of those things. But I really wanted to get it done. And when the opportunity came to me, it felt both a sort of, this is such a big part, such a big point in my career, something I absolutely need to get over the line and have always wanted to do. And so it felt like the end to that, but also it felt like the beginning of all the new possibilities. And, when we speak about football, we think the players learned, I can score a goal late, or we can come back from being 3 goals down to Barcelona, or, all these things you learn because you've done it, you've experienced it. I've now written a book, which I didn't think, I could do like a few years ago. I've done it, and now I'm so excited about what else I'm capable of doing.
Mel Reddy hasn't just written a book. She's written the book that you need about the 2019-2020 season and the journey that took us there. It is the book, Believe Us, How Jürgen Klopp Transformed Liverpool into Title Winners. It's on Harper North. If you cared about Liverpool being transformed into title winners, it is the book you need to buy and you need to read. It is an absolute belter. We will get on now with everybody else's. We have, in some degree of an order, I haven't clarified this in writing yet with Lizzie, so I will just say the names one after the other. We have Si Hughes, we have Dave Prentice, we have Dan Gray, and we have Adam and Rob from Magic Sponges as well. All of that is to come, but do most definitely believe us about this one. I am joined by Adam Bushby and Rob McDonald. The pairing make up Magic Sponges, who are behind this excellent new book, From the Jaws of Victory. Now, as I said in the opening, I have to declare an interest. One of the chapters is mine within there. So, of course, I'm going to say it's excellent. Of course I am. But it genuinely is excellent. It doesn't just have me. It has Scott Murray, John Ashdown, Andy Thomas, Patrick Barkley, Rob and Adam themselves, other people in there as well. Daniel Story's in there. Did I say Andy Thomas? If I didn't, I should have done what with being absolutely the business, Nicky Bandini. It is full of people who've written about Daniel Gray. You'll also hear on this show, have written about the idea of the team that nearly gets there, the person that nearly gets there. It's From the Jaws of Victory. And which of you two is responsible for the initial concept?
Well, 5 pints each. So
so it wasn't just you, Adam.
It wasn't just me. We had our help. But no, we, like our first book, we were having a few pints and we were discussing what we like to read. I think that's where most of our things come from. It's what we like to read. Now, I think in these last few years, there's been a marked improvement in the quality of stuff that we want to read, which to me is not just a blasé, you know, goal by goal, move by move. I don't want to hear that. Me and Rob are more inclined to read about the stories, you know, what the human stories, the human interest angle behind it all. And I think that's what we tried to achieve with this book. Would you say, Rob?
Yeah, I think we'd covered similar sorts of stories way back when on the blog, and this is an extension of those, really. So we revisited some that we'd talked about in the past. There's obviously some brand new ones that we've got in there as well. And I think, albeit as sort of Macclesfield and York/Liverpool fans respectively, we're not kind of that au fait with the glory particularly, but we are quite au fait with defeat. There's just a lot of stories in football. You know, for every piece of silverware, there's an awful lot of teams that didn't win it. And I think Andy says in his piece, which is about Wales, you know, Wales have not won the World Cup a number more times than Brazil have won it. So defeat and those sort of, everyone's got a story of why it's not happened for them. And I think these tend to be more familiar stories in football than the teams that won everything.
Well, I think as part of that, I think it is philosophically interesting, because the thing I always say, for instance, as an example, before a World Cup, is there's 32 teams enter, only one will win it. So there's got to be a purpose to what the other 31 do. As an example, you've got to show something of yourself, a degree of your national character or the game. And I think it is interesting, you know, there's a couple in there around that. There's Hungary and there's the Netherlands and there's Brazil from 82, the Netherlands from 74. They're always the high profile ones. But at all levels of football, Rob, you know, ultimately, football matches are not the boat race where one wins and one loses every year. There are a lot of people who are losing. And so therefore, then you have to be able to almost contrast and compare different flavours of defeat.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same, supporting your club is going to be modelled on that, whoever they are. Like you say, Neil, it's kind of, you know, it's very, very rare. I was quite lucky with Macclesfield that we won a league and survived on the last day in the last three seasons. But then obviously we disappeared out of existence a few weeks ago. So that's not a great example of like swings and roundabouts, because one's relatively more severe than the others. But it's, yeah, you know, every club's got their own story to tell. You're supporting your national team, everyone's got their own story to tell as well. And it's about access to games and access to teams and access to players comes at different times to different people, you know, to different clubs at different times. And it's all part of the kind of the wider engagement with the game. And I think, like I'd said at the top, that's kind of what we're interested in, is how people perceive and consume the game rather than just delving into it kind of move by move or match by match.
It can't, in terms of sport, Adam, and as I say, the book's terrific. In terms of sport, it cannot be the story of the winners. All sport, I'd say that's the case for, but certainly in terms of, you know, professional football and even amateur football, the stories that count cannot simply be the ones of the winners. Because if that is the case, it becomes so, so reductive. I think people find real joy in there and real kinship and real sort of camaraderie in the stories of not winning. Because they're the ones that are just easier to relate to on a human level.
Well, for me, football's never more interesting than when you're looking at the stories that are between the lines almost. It's between the lines of, well, for instance, me and Rob have just appeared on the TIFO podcast with Seb Stavablor, and I mentioned there that our cover picture is Gascoigne stretching for that ball in 96. And in that moment, you've got defeat and victory wrapped up in the cross, I would say. So it's, you see what I mean? You can watch it over and over, and I don't know still to this day how Gascoigne misses that ball. And I think that the story there for me is that if he scores it, the storyline's Gascoigne's, you know, and we presumably beat the Czech Republic. That's the narrative that we've heard. But alternatively, the reality is that he misses that, and then we talk about it 24 years later. It was interesting that you mentioned the word flavour earlier, the flavours of defeat. Not that this is scripted, as I think you'll realise listening to me personally, but I've written down flavour on the back of an envelope here, because I think that sums up the book perfectly. in terms of, we've got 23 chapters, and within those you've got the glorious defeat that me and Rob, I think, were initially going for. And then you've also got enduring defeat, which is the Garner story, where apparently Brooks excellently mentions the fact that Gian is still reliving that penalty miss 10 years on. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And then you've got bottlers, which I wouldn't necessarily class Newcastle as bottlers in 95, 96, because I think they were brilliant to watch. But, you know, it's been said since that they bottled it, and they've got the Keegan quote and the famous Keegan rant. And then you've got surprise packages. So Stuart Fuller talks about West Ham in 85, 86, I think it is, where they had this run where no one expected it and it came out of the blue. So I think within the book, we do touch on different flavours of defeat because there isn't just one.
Just to sort of sum it up, Rob, it's on Halcyon Publishing, and it is available. The other thing that must be, I'd like to think it's fun. You can tell me if it wasn't, and that can also include slagging me off if you want to go there, is working with a number of different authors. So you do, when we talk about flavours, we're not just there talking about the idea of the specific stories, but it's also talking about a huge breadth of writing styles and I suspect approaches within there. Is that exciting to you, for you? Do you enjoy that part of it?
Yeah, incredibly exciting. And I think more so when you consider sort of Adonai are kind of in the sphere of a lot of these writers because of something that we do as amateurs, really, because of the blog and stuff. And I think a lot of them, I think it was just Ad getting in touch with this kind of inner pest to sort of track a few people. But we're quite surprised, and I think I'm sure Ad's the same, like the reception that we got from a lot of people about the idea and about the concept, and because I think it does strike a chord, like we've been saying. But yeah, like amazing to sort of get messages and to speak to people like Patrick Barkley. I mean, we've known Andy like intimate for quite a long time, but yeah, yourself, Neil Brooks, John Nicholson, like people that we've read for years. But yeah, to be able to work with them on, and the nice thing as well, I think, is it's stories that they've wanted to tell. We had sort of a list of teams in mind that we thought needed to be covered if we were going to write a book about, you know, famous teams that didn't win anything. But there's a lot of space in there for people to make suggestions. So I think we originally approached Felipe about writing about Portugal, I think it was, but he wanted to write about Benfica and their sort of lack of a treble in that season, albeit it was a stepping stone to something else. But yeah, like we're sort of very, very lucky that people have sort of taken to the idea and the calibre of people that are in the book, yourself included. Hopefully we'll make it a real success.
Hopefully it will be a success. Listen, do definitely check it out. There'll be an excerpt. We're recording this on the Tuesday. It's going out on Thursday or Friday. So I think it'll be on the website by the time it goes out. We've just got to work it out because I've written about 13, 14, not for the first time, possibly for the last. I might have felt like I got it right this time, finally, focusing in solely on Steven. And it was a different thing to write about it in the context of Liverpool having won the league as well, because it did change the sort of the outlook and the perception and the tone. So I was pleased to do that. They asked me for 3,000 words. They got 4,500. I apologise again. it is called From the Jaws of Victory. It's on Halcyon Publishing. Hopefully you'll find it the absolute business. It was a joy for me to do, and I think it was for everyone as well. It is out by the time you're listening to this. Do check it out. Do give it all the support that you can. Do share it. And if you do buy it, you know, the point about books like this is they're meant to be shared across the football supporting spectrum. It is not solely or indeed entirely for Liverpool supporters, but the point is to find that kinship. So do basically tell your mates. Thank you very much to Adam. Thank you very much to Rob. Christmas presents don't get much better than this one. And now joined by Dave Prentice, because the thing is, Evertonians get Christmas as well. And if you know any Blues, there's a book well worth reading, a grand old team to report on, by David Prentice, our Blue brethren stepping up. And Dave, it's a book that is, you know, it says the subtitle of it is 45 years around Everton. It is a book that is a long time in the making, because you really have been there so consistently, covering this side, following its fortunes, ups and downs, and it is both with the Blues, as we know. Yeah. But it's been, you know, you've been grafting away at this for a long, long time, but always with a great deal of enjoyment around it.
Yeah, I had to leave it that long because I wanted to beat Reedy's book. He had 43 years with the same bird. So I had to wait until I could get 45 years on there. 1975 is when I first set foot inside Goodison Park, Easter Monday against Coventry. So it is genuinely 45 years of following Everton, initially as a supporter, perched on a crash barrier in the old enclosure, and then obviously, you know, saw a career writing about them for Everton. And it's something I wanted to do for a long, long time. And I genuinely thought that I probably would never have the time to commit to it. And I just thought, tail end of last year, look, I really need to get stuck into this. I really need to do it. I had about 10,000 words knocked together in anecdotal, you know, form of just stories, some of the entertaining stories in there, the ones with Peter Johnson, you know, so Graham Stewart, you know, going out drinking with players. I put them together in the form of, you know, little files in my inbox, just so that I didn't forget them, you know, so that they were there. And I had about 10,000 words together and thought, right, I need to do something with this. So I went to see the publishing arm of our place just before Christmas, Steve Hanrahan. Said, would you be interested in it as, you know, as a concept? And they were very enthusiastic. Said, oh yeah, we'd love to do it, but we'd like to do it in term for the Christmas market 2020. Could you commit to it? Now, never having done one of this scale before, I said, well, I don't know. Simple answer. So I've got 10,000 words knocked together. What do you need? He says, we need 80,000 words by June. And I thought, oh my God, right. Well, okay. I said, I'll tentatively commit. I won't sign anything, but, you know, I'll get stuck into it. I'll let you know how it's going. And I'll let you know as soon as possible if I'm, you know, likely to get it completed in time. And as we know, the world went into lockdown. I was sat at home, you know, every day, saving about an hour and a half's worth of commute time every day. So I got well and truly stuck into it. And I have to say, I had it done by June. So, you know, so race through it. So
one of the things that comes through, well, we're doing this over Zoom, just in case listeners don't know. And behind, I can actually see with Dave, I can see he's got a copy of a James Elroy book behind him and on the other side, Dave. And one of the things that when I was sort of, I haven't read it all, Dave, I haven't, you know, firstly, it's a long book about Everton, but also I have sort of worked through, you know, parts of it. And I think, and it rattles along. And one of the things I get from it is, that's why the Elroy thing's just dead interesting, and it caught my eye. Yeah. There's tons of pace to it. Yeah. And I wonder if that's in part because the way in which you ended up writing it, like you've clearly got a very clear number of stories you want to tell. You mentioned Peter Johnson, and that's such a cornerstone that I think Liverpool supporters sort of overlook because we've got Hicks and Gillette. We forget what Peter Johnson was to Blues.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're rattling through there, this pace of this, you know, you feel the speed of this 45 years is coming around every corner.
Yeah. I mean, when I first had the idea, I was talking to a few people about it. I remember one guy said to me, well, what's your overarching theme going to be? You know, so what is your message? And I'm thinking, well, message, it's just literally a chronological stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, it's my story, you know, so from watching Everton as a kid to writing about them for a career. And there's a number of stories I wanted to get in there. And I wanted it to be a page turner. I didn't want any chapter to be longer than, you know, so 5 or 6 pages. I wanted people to be able to flick through it, like you say, at pace. And there's, you know, best parts of 300 pages in there. But everybody that's referenced it to me says that they have, like, read through it very, very quickly. You know, it has been a page turner, which is what I was hoping for. And they've enjoyed it. So, yeah, I just wanted to get all the messages in there, all the stories in there. I wanted to try and also just reference how the world has changed, certainly the journalistic world, since, you know, when I first stepped through the door of the Daily Post in 1987 to, you know, how we often operate now. And it is a completely different landscape. I mean, the Peter Johnson tales, I mean, I was given a very privileged insight into the machinations of an Everton chairman, because his partner at the time, Lorraine Rodgers, was an old school pal of mine. And that was just like a bizarre situation where myself and Paul Joyce, who was working for the Evertonian at the time, had gone over to his house in the Wirral to get the results of a ground poll survey. Yes, Everton had them 25, 30 years ago. I think they are a lot closer towards getting the stadium on this occasion. But back then, myself and Joyce had gone over, knocked on the door, and this girl, you know, so answered the door in an apron. And I just thought she was like his home helper, his PA. You know, we rushed into the kitchen. He poured us a glass of wine, and we sat there sipping the wine, and she's staring at me, and I'm thinking, am I sleeping here? Am I also doing something wrong? And she goes, it's David Prentice, isn't it? I said, the penny dropped then. Oh my God, it's Lorraine, isn't it? We used to sit together in English lessons. Peter was appalled. Oh my God, you know each other. You know each other. So yeah, it was as a result, I became quite friendly with him then. And all manner of stories cropped up as a result of that. I mean, when I was giving him a really hard time, which he deserved, by the way, Lorraine thought it would be a good idea if she got us together in the south of France and had this south of France, because England were playing then the World Cup, and I was there covering the World Cup for the Echo, and Peter was watching it as a fan, and she thought it'd be a good idea to get us together to try and have this like peace summit and try and bury the hatches. So I said, okay, well, I'm willing to do this. You know, England had played Tunisia in Marseille. So I went to meet him after the game in some bar in the middle of Marseille, which was a bizarre experience anyway. And he then goes, well, come on, we'll go back to the boat. I'm thinking, go back to the boat. So he puts me in this 4x4. We then drive down from Marseille to the Saint-Tropez, which is like about 60-odd, 70-odd kilometres. Puts me up on his yacht for the night. I'm there on this like multi-millionaire's yacht trying to explain to him why I've called him a blundering, inept, crass, you know, sort of. It was a very, very surreal situation. But yeah, it's, you know, the kind of thing that possibly wouldn't happen nowadays.
No, I think it almost certainly wouldn't. But I think that, as I say, you're telling that story as you're driving through the book, this sort of idea of when you say about how it had changed, how it was different. Yeah. Within there, you know, I feel as though there's a slight, because of what happens in, you know, 83 coming through into 85, 86, that, you know, there's a tiny little bit of a sadness that you weren't able to be covering Everton for that era, that you don't get all the peak stuff with Howard, because it's quite clear, and it's clear with so many Evertonians who you speak to who got to spend time with Howard Kendall, exactly how mesmerizing and how intriguing a figure he is for Blues, how, you know, that he is rightly sort of the Everton's greatest ever manager. And it is, you know, you're almost covering him second time round, not first. Yeah. And that comes through just as a, you know, a little bit of a sadness for you that you didn't get him first time round as well, however fabulous his company was second.
Up to a point, because I think I just about got the timing absolutely spot on, because from 83 through to 87, I started the Daily Post in April 87, I was a fan. And so, you know, so I went to all the games.
So you got to live it as a fan, yeah.
So I loved it. And, you know, I started working at the Formby Times in 1984. And I remember my news editor told me to go around to Howard's house, just around the corner from here in Argamel's Road. In fact, it's the site where Fabinho lives now. Howard's old house has been knocked down and Fabinho has built this absolute mansion on the site. I'm sure he's unaware of that. But, you know, so I had to go around to his house and where his first wife, Cynthia, was living, and knock on the door and, you know, basically ask if she would do an interview about her life as a, you know, football widow, they call it, you know, so basically, you know, so a husband's away watching football all the time. And she was charming. She was gracious. I never got to meet Howard then. I just got to meet her. But then, when I started the Daily Post, you know, I got to know Howard professionally after that. And obviously, you know, so he left to go to Spain at the end of the 87 season. So it was when he came back second time round that I became close to him professionally. And that didn't last very long at all, because obviously he resigned in December 1993. But again, only living around the corner, got to bump into him all the time and got to know him socially then. And everything you've heard about him is true. He was a beautiful, beautiful man. Great company, you know, so lovely, lovely fella. And so I got the best of both worlds. I got to experience, you know, so the legend of the teams he created the best way as a fan. And then I got to actually experience him, you know, professionally a little bit later when I was a little bit older. So I don't really feel like I missed out, to be honest.
Oh, no, I wouldn't want to quite phrase it like that, but it is that sort of that strange sort of thing. When you then, one of the things that also comes through is when you're going through the book, is that there is that relaxed relationship with Howard, and that was the way in which he went about business. And then you're almost dealing with more and more structured ones with the managers that follow, with David Moyes moving through. And as football becomes that sort of bigger business, that the feeling that you get kept a tiny little bit more from certain bits and pieces, like the very thing you described there with Peter Johnson before, when you said you wouldn't get it now, that sort of underpins the experience from David Moyes moving through to the managers that succeed him.
I actually used the metaphor at the beginning of the book that, you know, I started in journalism just as football clubs started to pull the drawbridge up on the media. Yeah. And that's absolutely true. I mean, I was fortunate in this, you know, I inherited the routine of my predecessors. Ken Rogers used to go down every single morning and have a cup of tea with Howard and then talk about what was in the morning papers, then come back and write a story for that day's Echo. And so I inherited that situation. And fortunately, subsequent managers were always prepared to do that. I mean, Howard did it second time around, Joe Royal did it, Walter Smith. Despite what people hear of Walter, he's top company, top, top fella. David Moyes, exactly the same. I know he's can be perceived correctly as a very dour individual, but he's 100% honest, David. I mean, of all the managers I worked with, he's the only one that never told me a lie. Absolutely straight as a die. But when Everton moved to Finch Farm in 2007, and I think they took the opportunity then to try and keep the Echo at a little bit more arm's length, because, you know, the football landscape was changing. I mean, there was when I started, it was like, national newspapers, local newspapers, and a couple of, you know, local radio stations. That was about it. Maybe Club Call. But then you started getting, you know, Sky TV in 1992. You then started getting the rise of the internet and all the various independent fan sites. And so the clubs started getting more and more demands on their manager, on their players' time. And they just couldn't possibly, you know, sort of allow everybody, you know, airtime. So I understand why they started to keep us more and more at arm's length. And the move to Finch Farm in 2007 gave them the opportunity to do that. Right, we're going to a new training ground. Therefore, you can only come down when you're invited, not every single day, as I did. So disappointing. And I don't think it really needed to be that way. I mentioned about Wayne Rooney in there when he became the England captain only about 3 or 4 years ago. And he said to Gareth Southgate, he goes, look, I want the media to actually stay in the same hotel as us. And I want them to travel with us where possible, because I want this level of trust and openness to try and, you know, sort of persist. Yeah. And I understand why he said that, because that was, you know, basically what he'd have witnessed as a young kid back at Everton. And it's healthy having that kind of relationship. Now, whether he ever succeeded, whether that, you know, Gareth Southgate agreed to that, I don't know. But it's something that he wanted to happen at the England setup. And it harked back, really, you know, sort of to a different era when, you know, the lines were blurred and a great deal more trust was attached, you know, sort of to the media.
Well, the book is available now. It is through Reach Publishing. It is A Grand Old Team to Write For by David Prentice. Do check it out. And as I say, do check it out for you. I would recommend anybody have a little look through it. But also, if you are looking for something special for Christmas, for that Evertonian in your life, thank you very much to Dave. Let's get ourselves along. Joined by Si Hughes to talk about the Athletic's book, At the End of the Storm, about Liverpool's first league title in 30 years. Obviously, there's a number of these books. This one takes a lot of the excellent work done through the season by Ollie Kay, James Pearce and Si in particular through there. And just to the really strange thing about it all, Si, I remember talking to a number of different people covering Liverpool over the course of the campaign. Like, there really was this feeling that you were covering and doing something really rather momentous in this Liverpool title winning season, that there's some sort of moment when you realise that you're not just chronicling another Liverpool season where they come close. There's a moment when you realise and you're chronicling the first championship in 30 years.
Well, I think that moment for me, I've spoken about this quite a lot, was at Villa, which first week of November, it's still quite early in the season.
It is early, you went that early.
Yeah, I went that early. I remember coming home from that game thinking, I haven't seen this before, Liverpool scoring two late goals as late as that and turning a result around. And I think I must have gone down to that game with Neil Jones, who obviously you know well. And I remember coming back in the car thinking, this is a bit different this season. Obviously, they'd started the season really well. They'd had a little bit of a bump at Old Trafford, but still managed to get a point in that game. And I just remember coming back from Villa thinking, I can't see. I thought if they beat Man City, which was obviously the following week, it was a really important week that. So, you know, this is going to be the year. I went that early. I remember saying that. I actually said that on another podcast quite early and sort of regretted it instantly.
You're not a man for a big shout, Si. So
no,
I'm
not.
You must have been up nights.
Yeah, I'm usually quite cautious when it comes to stuff like that. But it just did feel different. And I'll never forget that the scenes in Villa Park that day. I mean, the funniest scene was actually there's a video that went up. You've probably seen, you know, Torben, the Norwegian. Torben Flatten, Norwegian fan who used to do the Kopite magazine, is like quite a reserved sort of character, and pandemonium's going on around him and everyone's just jumping on top of each other. And Torben, who I've never seen like become an emotional person at all, just a little smile went across his face and he started clapping his hands. I thought, this is going to be the season Liverpool win the league.
That's your marker point. There is something with it when, you know, when within the book, obviously with you, with James and with Ollie, you've been writing about Liverpool for so many years and different bits of Liverpool, and it obviously stems from the beginning of the season. But there was something there before then as well, not just the winning of the Champions League. Like, I remember sort of thinking a couple of times across the last sort of 2 or 3 years in summers, there's a momentum, there's a drumbeat here, there's the idea that it'll be difficult for Liverpool to keep being denied. And I think that's something which comes over in the book and it comes over in the writing as well, that you feel like the universe is sort of arcing in our general direction.
Well, I think it's difficult to sort of disconnect the season they won the league from the previous season where they win the Champions League. It just felt like one continuous ride, really. Because I remember at the start of 2019-20, I was thinking, I'm not quite ready for this yet. You know, like sort of, it felt like the glow of being in Madrid and working on a Champions League final, which Liverpool won, and obviously just being there from a fan's point of view, I didn't want that memory to sort of just fade, sort of go away quickly. I wanted to sort of live on that for as long as I possibly could, really. And when the next season started, I didn't feel quite ready for it, if I'm being totally honest. But so, yeah, I agree with that. It feels like the story is not just a one season. It's not one season. It's been building over the course of several seasons, really, hasn't it? I mean, when you think about Liverpool from 2015 onwards, there's obviously been some disappointments along the way in terms of the results in finals or not quite getting to where they want to be. But you can just see the progression year on year on year, the team getting better and better and better and stronger and stronger. And having won the Champions League, I just think it just gave them that confidence as a team as a fan base, really, that things were going to go right when it matters. Like the sort of, it wiped away that whole, certainly amongst the fan base and some to some degree the city, that sort of fatalistic thing that was creeping in a little bit into the thinking, oh God, you know, like after what happens in Kiev, when everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. Mm. It could have gone either way, I think, after that. But I think because people had such a good weekend and because it was sort of accepted that Liverpool had gone so far and unexpectedly, I think that, you know, as I said, I'm sort of connecting all different seasons here. It just feels like it's all part of the same story, which it is, because obviously it's the same manager, isn't it?
It is, but it is that sort of the other thing that gets dropped in, and it is worth sort of remembering the, obviously, and it's detailed within the book, and the book is very much worth reading, the sort of the COVID interruption, followed by then the strangeness of, and I know that you all felt it in a different way, just from sort of casual conversations from people who were covering Liverpool at the time. I want to say fortunate enough to still, for instance, be in the ground for certain games, but it's a bit of a double-edged sword, isn't it? It sort of disconnected those of you who were writing about the team from what everybody else was going through. And also it was every single journalist I've spoken to who's been in, and I've done some of the women's games, and it is a genuinely quite odd experience. You sort of do struggle to put it into words, and yet obviously you're well aware that if anything, the responsibility to get the right thing, the right piece, the right outlook is ever greater when, you know, when that's going on around you.
Yeah, well, I definitely feel that way. I mean, I think my job sort of changed from when they won the Champions League, when I was at the Independent, where it was sort of the match coverage and match-focused content. And that obviously the Athletic said to me, well, we sort of want you doing more, slightly more broader things. So you're not going to be at as many matches in a working capacity, but we want you to still be there to obviously get the flavour of and maintain your contacts and everything else. So I'd sort of got used to the not being at the matches so much, you know, towards the end of the season. James Pearce was covering a lot of the matches, or all the matches after lockdown. So I felt certainly a stronger sense of, I guess, you know, from a fan's point of view, being that I was at a lot of the games last season, you know, in the stands on my match ticket rather than being in the press box. So
yeah.
So I experienced my...
Did that change, did you feel that changed your writing a little bit throughout the whole course of last season? Because it's the first time that's happened to you in a while.
Yeah. I don't know, really. I mean, it's difficult to say because, like, there are times when you obviously you're invested emotionally in the game, but you've got to... It's a difficult skill when you're particularly doing matches because you've got to let a little bit of that emotion come into your reporting, because obviously football is an emotional game, but equally when you've got a job to do, you can't let that consume your writing or your thoughts or your interpretation of what's going on. So you've got to let a little bit in without being totally overwhelmed by it. I remember the certain games where obviously that's been very hard. I mean, Borussia Dortmund was one of the hardest ones because it was such a quick sort of turnaround in the last 10, 15 minutes. And then Barcelona being another one, which was just, you know, I don't need to explain that. I mean, it was an insane event to report on. But I suppose that last season, I sort of reconnected with why people go and watch football a lot more. I think sometimes when you're in the press box, you do feel certain detachments from the emotional, financial, physical, every single element of why people go and watch football matches. And hopefully it may have benefited my writing in some ways. I don't think it's... I've enjoyed the job a lot more in that sense. I've loved the last 12 months. But in terms of feeling like you've sort of missed out a little bit on the league, I think everybody feels like that to some extent, even like the lads who were, say, or the reporters who were inside the ground on the when they lifted the trophy. You know, there was a sense of loss there, I think, when you speak to the lads afterwards, because, you know, obviously, I think everybody for the last 30 years who I know has sort of visualised that moment of realisation when the final whistle is blown and the whole stadium erupts. I think we had a feeling of that, didn't we, when Liverpool got to the last day the season before against Wolves, and for 30 seconds or whatever, however long it was.
Yeah.
Even now I sort of get goose pimples thinking about that, because, you know, thinking about that, because it was that moment of thinking, oh my God, it's going to happen and we're here. And, you know, from a personal point of view, how do you sort of get your job done, you know, while something like this is happening? But yeah, the one thing I will say is, I mean, I feel quite fortunate in that when they lifted the trophy, which I don't really place too much value in the actual trophy lifts so much for some reason. It was always about that moment of the final whistle blowing, just seeing the reaction then. But I felt quite lucky that I was actually surrounded by my mates in a pub at that moment, because in a normal circumstance, I don't think I would have been, I think I would have either been at work and not surrounded by journalists. Not saying that I don't like journalists, but you know, I was able to actually experience that feeling with people that I've obviously had these shared experiences with over the last 30 years in a way that I would not have been able to if I was working, so, or at the match. So I think a lot of people have said that, though, haven't they? I'm sure you watched that moment around people that you would not normally sit around or stand around, people you'd sometimes maybe prefer to be with. So in that sense, I feel like that moment became a lot more special because of it.
Excellent stuff. It is at the end of the storm. Stories from Liverpool's historical title win, from the award-winning, it says here, writers of The Athletic. I'm sure you've got an award somewhere, haven't you? Man of the match at some point in a game.
Yeah,
there'll be one. You'll have one.
I'll just
James,
take that.
James,
yeah,
and Ollie, you've got James and Ollie, you've got shelves of them, mate. Don't you worry at all. It is James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and Si Hughes. Do check it out. Do get hold of it. It is an absolute pleasure to be joined by Daniel Gray to talk about his latest Extra Time, 50 Further Delights of Modern Football. And Daniel, I think that you in your preface, you go out of your way to say you almost gave yourself the job of it being modern football. You actually use the phrase, it would be easy to do 50 rants. But within this, you know, there's a lovely chapter, for instance, on, and I was so pleased when I saw it, the wondrousness of team talks on the pitch during extra times. I love them as well. As soon as you get to see it, that sort of dynamic and the way in which some people are paying attention, some people aren't, but all the way through, what you've chosen to do this time is to eschew the nostalgia and say, no, there's still all this stuff to love about football.
Yeah, and luckily it was all written while we were still at matches. I finished it in about February, so, because I don't know how easy it would be to write at the moment, but I'm hoping it sort of acts as a bridge and takes people back there until we can get in there in some ways. But you're absolutely right. I'm glad you've picked up on that. There's so much we can moan about the game, but there's so much to love still. And I've never been a sort of against modern football person. There's loads I dislike about modern football and that I'm against, but there's much to celebrate, or we wouldn't bother. You wouldn't have this podcast. You wouldn't be making a living out of this. People wouldn't be listening. It's a wonderful thing. It's the greatest sport on earth, quite clearly. And for me, the greatest pastime to indulge in.
There's a chapter in there, and I could just sort of go through them, to be honest with you. I absolutely loved reading it. Spotting a first match fan. And genuinely, I love it as well. A couple of times that I've written sort of post-match, once when I was very close to people who were at the ground for the first time, that idea that for somebody somewhere in that ground, it's the first match they've been to. Someone for whom that's happening, that this thing's happening in front of them. And every now and again, especially when you are a bit jaded and it's mid-December, my God, the ball won't even stay in play. I like the idea of thinking to myself, you know what, someone somewhere, this is pure magic. It's the first time they've got one of these.
Yeah, and you're there at that one of the most important parts of a person's life. It's lovely to think that must be happening. The odds are that's happening in most
every game.
Grounds every week, and they might never go again, or they might become addicted like us. And it's wonderful to be at the very start of that, and to spot it is a glorious thing. You can see a grandparent or a parent proudly showing them their world and pointing things out, and the kid has never seen that many people in one place before. And that's exactly what I remember about all of these are supposed to be hopefully universal. What did we feel like when we first went to a game, and transposing it to now, because it is going on, and the kid is finding it every bit as magical. And they're probably not even bothered about VAR or anything. Just all about the occasion and having that this mad, because a football ground is just a strange place when you think about it. These four stands looking down on this lime green pitch, all of the visuals of it and the sounds and the smells. The kids never ever experienced that anywhere else. It's a wondrous thing.
It's possibly, I was thinking about this the other day, that separate in a strange way to public parks, it's possibly one of the biggest man-made areas of green you ever see. Mm. The thing about public parks is it's this idea of, in cities and towns, it's this idea of capturing a degree of wilderness and keeping it within the city. Whereas the thing about the football stadium is, it's the idea that this is all entirely built. Men, women, people have decided to make this thing be a thing in this space. And yeah, when you stop to think about that for a second, that just the simple size of the green rectangle is something which it is completely artificial. That grass was not there. They are bringing that grass in. Yeah. But it is, and it is this sort of this oddly imposed thing on the landscape.
So, absolutely. And it's amazing they got away with it in some ways when you think about, you know, think of Anfield, Goodison, Blundell Park, all of those town centre grounds that just punctuate terrace streets. It's amazing they didn't build houses there and make more money of it. And you know, it's one of the few things you can pick out from a plane, isn't it?
Yeah.
The football ground, great flying over Liverpool, for instance, and you can see Tranmere as well. One of the... You wouldn't really get away with it now in the middle of a town. It's fair to say. It's just not worth enough coin, is it?
It's not worth anyone's hassle. I'll come back to the book in a minute while I've got you, because I'm dreadful like this. Just a brief chat about watching the side that have, in the last seven games, six goals have hit the back of the net with Middlesbrough. But it is actually going really rather well. Most of those six goals have been Middlesbrough goals.
Yeah.
And I'm loath to say they're driving their way up the table, having played 11 and only scored 9. But this is a side at the minute that's remarkably difficult to beat, and they find themselves 4 points off the top.
It is, and it's very different football to the Tony Pulis style of defensive football. I have to say, at Blackburn, the first half last week, it was like we had 12 or 13 players, and we haven't often seen that with Borough. The type of football you've been used to under Klopp, really, the energy of them. And you just, it's remarkable that a 71-year-old man can get a reaction from 20-year-old players. It amazes me. I was going to say a father figure, but it's a granddad figure, isn't it? And you tend to respect your granddad a bit more than you do your dad, perhaps. There's maybe some of that going on. An amazing turnaround. Very small squad. Often we've only had one forward in the squad due to illness and injury. Great to see three or four academy lads playing, because Warnock isn't the type that plays academy lads, really, but he has to. And I'm glad his hand's been forced in that way. I don't know how long it can last because of the thinness of the squad, but what a turnaround, given how miserable we were at the turn of the year with it all.
Just a last little thing then about the book, which I would recommend to anybody you know should be reading Extra Time, 50 Further Delights of Modern Football. They really, really should. You've got a little bit in there around local radio, and I was putting some shelves up in ours on Saturday, and I ended up on BBC Radio London because I just wanted to listen to Crystal Palace versus Leeds whilst I was doing it, as something to have in the background. And then from there, I'd forgotten it was first round of the FA Cup day, and they're going around these grounds, and it was this unbelievably evocative, predominantly, albeit, you know, London grounds. In hindsight, I probably should have flicked over to Merseyside, but I was just absolutely loving, suddenly I'm over at Dagenham and Redbridge, I'm back over here into Bromley. And that sort of thing, that local radio still just has this ability to absolutely transport you, is something which, you know, I think is really important for us to not just dwell on, but also cling to.
Absolutely, because there can't be many countries on earth that have that network. And you know your commentator of your team from your local radio. You've gone through all those moments with him or her. And they've, when you haven't been at the away, they're the person who's, yep, got you there usually and transported you there, and by their words, it's such an important role. And yet, like you say, you go across the dial, or you know, use the app now, and you've never heard this guy before in your life. You don't have a clue who the expert summariser is either.
I didn't know who I was trying to work out, what Paul is this?
Yeah, every time. And they've usually not got the local accent either. It's someone that signed for that club and stayed around. And so you know, you get a Scouser on BBC T's doing Hartlepool and a Scott doing Brent and stuff, and you think, who's this? But your own one, you know very well, Middlesbrough's is Neil Maddison, and you'll think, Neil Maddison, I sort of remember him at Southampton, but to us, he's Maddo, he's the expert summariser. and we've all got that. And that, I made it chapter one, because it was one of the ones that I liked and was most pleased with, but also I just thought, what a great role to celebrate in changing media times where less is solid and there's all sorts of ways you can get your football. Actually, there's still a very traditional thing going on everywhere from BBC York to BBC Lincolnshire and all the rest.
Are you working on another one of these, Daniel? I know you're a man who works in a number of different fronts at once. Are you looking at doing another? I mean, let's sell this one first and foremost. I will say again, extra time, do check it out. But are you looking to work on another one? Are you keeping these up when they occur to you?
I'm keeping the list up. I don't know right now if I could do it again, because it sounds ridiculous. It's hardly coal mining, but it sort of takes it out of your writing at that level of love for the game. Sometimes it'll be nice to do something a bit more. I'd like to do something a bit more similar to, I did a book called Hatters, Railwaymen and Knitters, where I went round various matches in towns. So I'd love to do a football travel book again. I've managed to get to 6 games this season in the Northern League and Northern Premier League. And the idea of writing about the quest just to see a match in the time of COVID quite appeals to me at the minute, the sort of things I'm seeing. So I am still writing things down, and I've got it in my mind. I'd like to do one of these about the people that make football happen. So like the local radio commentator, but can you do 600 words on a turnstile operator? I'm not sure. That'll be the fruit we'll see.
It's a challenge. If anyone can, I think you may well be able to. It is an absolute pleasure. It's an absolute delight. It's extra time. 50 for the delights of modern football by Daniel Gray. Do keep your eye out on all of Daniel's work. He works across a number of different forms. Do check him out as well on social media. Best place to find you, Daniel, on Twitter is what?
D_Gray_writer.
There we go. Everything that
there's
you need.
There's damn underscores.
They don't come up anywhere. They never come up anywhere else in life. But it is a pleasure as ever to speak to Daniel. And do check the book out at your first opportunity. Sports Social Podcast Network.